You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, hey! It's everyone's favorite Broadway cyber hacker, Drew Gasparini, here with another episode of Now We're Talking, the podcast that Oprah Winfrey calls a huge waste of everyone's time. But Oprah doesn't know shit because everyone and their mom is going to want to hear today's episode. Our guest today has been seen in the first national tour of Kinky Boots. She's been in off-Broadway shows such as Jasper in Deadland, and she starred as Pamela in the Broadway musical Head Over Heels. She can also be seen in her hundreds of concert appearances in New York City every year, and heck, you can even hear her on my album, We Aren't Kids Anymore. I am so thrilled she is here because she's amazing. Ladies and gentlemen, now we're talking with Bonnie Milligan.
Dive in, we're recording. I am here with the most fabulous, Bonnie Milligan. How are you, Bonnie?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm so thrilled you're here because...
Me too.
You know, I think the way that I know you is just kind of funny, and the way that like our friendship kind of started was very recently, but we've been within these all the same circles for such a long time. And I just like adore talking to you. And I'll tell you what did it. Here's what did it. We were in the studio. We were in Brooklyn and we were recording my album, We Aren't Kids Anymore. Plug, plug, plug. Everybody go check it out.
It's amazing.
But we were having sandwiches and we were just eating. It was like a break. And I remember talking sandwiches with you. And I was, and I looked at your sandwich and I looked at my sandwich and I was like, damn, I was so out ordered here. And I fell in love with you. That's really what did it. I fell in love with you.
Sandwiches are very serious business. It's all about ratio. It's all about everything.
Absolutely. No one can see this. I can see this, but you have like a little shrine to yourself behind you. What is this framed picture? Does it say like certificate of excellence?
You actually see it. No. So I'm in Ohio at my mom's currently. And so
amazing.
This, of course, she has in the other one. That is the street art that was done of me in 19 something. I don't even remember. I was five.
Gosh. Wow.
You're welcome. In New York.
Yeah, thank you.
And then that is my back when 54 Below used to do actual like sandwich board posters outside before they went digital. That was from my original solo show. Afterwards, my mom was like, can I get the posters outside?
That's amazing.
She went and had it like cut up and framed. So she
no one else has done this, by the way.
Your mom
got something very special. I don't know anybody else who's done this.
My mom went Midwest. So she actually, I do have one of these in New York in my apartment because she gave me one. And then she has the other that is hanging in here.
Well, that's not the only solo show you've done at 54, or is that the only solo
show?
No,
it was just the very first.
Very first. So that is kind of a big stamp of the holy shit, look at my kid, I'm so proud moment. That's really awesome. Bonnie, before we get really into the juice.
Oh God.
Into the deep, the French dip of juiciness.
Oh, that sounds good.
It does. I'm hungry. Because I started right away talking about sandwiches and now I'm like starving. I have a problem and I want to see if you have the same problem as I have. This has nothing to do with you. This really has nothing to do with you. This is just a thought I had moments before we started this podcast.
Okay, great.
And I just want to see what your take is. I want to get Bonnie's hot take on this. In Aladdin, the movie Aladdin.
Yeah.
How long does Aladdin know Jasmine before he does the line, do you trust me? And do we think it's an okay example to set for young women that immediately you say yes to someone? Is it because he's shirtless? Is it because he happens to have a rug that flies around and a monkey pal? All of those things I just said, by the way, are totally reasons to not trust somebody.
Fact.
Why does Jasmine go for it?
Well, I mean, the first time he says it to her, he doesn't even have all the accoutrement of a flying rug yet because
he first
says it to her in the market when he's trying to help her escape the guards.
That's right.
And he's like, do you trust me? And that's when they jump out the window and thankfully land on awning.
I know. The whole fucking town is made of awnings that are like trampolines that you can just bounce from one to the other.
Supple awning. You can either hold you like a baby or it's like a trampoline. And it's like, how do you know which awning is which? What if you were looking for supple hold?
Name of this episode is Supple Awnings with Bonnie Milligan. I love that. The whole name of this podcast might just change to Supple Awnings.
Oh, God, I'd click on that. Like, what is that?
Yes, supple is such an intriguing word in the first place. It's alluring. It pulls you right in.
Like the awning would.
I was having a real issue with this today. I just can't. I'm kind of like, I had all this respect for Jasmine, and immediately I was like, well, now wait a minute. Now I really lost a little respect for the jazz.
The jazz.
We're tight. Well, I call her the jazz.
He gets her out of her accidentally stealing the apple because bitch doesn't know about paying for money because she's a princess. Great.
Right.
And she's like, I just wanted the apple. You mean I can't just take it? How removed are you, Jazz?
I mean, it's kind of, that's,
you don't know that people deal with money.
The Winona Ryder situation. Remember when she was like caught shoplifting and you're like, Winona Ryder, you're a billionaire with all the movies you've done. How come you're not just paying for these things? And I think it's when you have enough money that you totally forget what it's for. That's what I really think happens.
You forget about,
you forget what it's for. You and I don't have this problem right now. You're in your mom's house in Ohio.
Yeah.
And I am in my parents' basement in Northern California, as you can see by the grotesque amount of community theater memorabilia that we have hanging on the wall.
Oh, it's community.
Here.
See, it just, from here, it just looks like a bunch of like Broadway posters.
No, I know. I have you fooled. If you zoom in on what's actually being said here, it's like a young people's production. All of them say that. This is where Matt Doyle and I met. Matt Doyle and I met doing all of these shows when we were young little children.
Babies. I love it.
You know, this is a perfect way to segue into where I've started with all of our guests. So I haven't told you anything about this podcast, have I?
No, not a bit.
Do you like going in? Do you like just diving in with me, knowing nothing about what we're going to be talking about?
I mean, sure, right?
Do you trust me?
Oh, God, Aladdin.
Yeah, we're gonna pray for some supple awnings to catch us along the way. I wanted to do this podcast. You know, when I hear a lot of these Broadway podcasts, it's always like broad wasted or like what, you know, there's always some Broadway pun going on. And inevitably we talk about our theater nerd self. And I don't mind going into that. And I'm sure we'll brush upon it. That's just the nature of who we are. We're really in the industry. That's part of our thing. What I really want to get to is the parts of you that not everybody could necessarily Google. I mean, we could talk your resume, but shit, that's all over the goddamn internet. You know what I'm saying? True. So you're in Ohio right now. Why don't we start there? Are you from Ohio originally? Tell us everything about your childhood.
Oh, God. Well, originally Central Illinois. Like, Decatur, which is where Millikan University is.
Oh, I've been to Millikan University.
Sure.
Is that where Sierra Boggess went?
Yes. Yes.
I totally taught a master class there. Did you go there?
No, I did a musical theater camp there when they had that.
Amazing.
Yeah. No, I never went there because I didn't want to be 5 minutes from, because also it's expensive, but they were going to give me a lot of money. And
like a scholarship. But,
yeah, lots of scholarship, not just like under the table. Like,
yeah, just like we thought you could use this.
Like, come on. And you're like, what? And I was like, I don't want money. No, not that. Scholarships. I hate money. I want to struggle so my art is better.
Yeah.
No, like the thing then would have been I needed to live with my grandma to go there. And she lived like 5 minutes from campus. And I was like, I don't want to I want to have that experience of, you know, all the things.
Yeah. Right? Isn't part of college kind of like losing yourself so you can figure out who you are?
Making tons of mistakes.
All the
mistakes.
And living
the dream. All of them.
You're falling without a supple awning at all. It's an awningless fall. That's what college should be.
And if there is one, it's a trampoline. You're bouncing into something else and you don't know what it is.
100%.
Yeah. I like that we keep bringing that back. It feels good. So I was there and it was super, super small. Like where I grew up in a double wide trailer where our trailer was, which my grandparents owned. You want the real nitty gritty. I'm giving it
to you. I do. I really do. I already have 10 questions just about the double wide trailer, but please keep going.
We can talk about it. So my grandparents owned like, I don't know, like five, doesn't sound like a bunch, but like, I don't know how many acres, but a fair amount of acres. And what would have been the equivalent to probably like an avenue in New York City was a just an open kind of meadow situation, and you could walk through that, and that's where our trailer was. So it was a different street, but directly behind their house. Wow. And I would walk through that field to get, and I caught the bus at my grandma's every day because my trailer was at the end of a dead end road, and the bus wouldn't come down the road.
This sounds so, like magical as a childhood experience, but it also sounds like the beginning of like 10 Dateline episodes that I've watched.
Oh, God. It could go either way.
Yeah.
It could go either way. Exactly. No, there were like, they had a garden out there, and then they had, you know, pear trees and apple trees, and all that was kind of like as you walked from the little field, whatever, from my house to theirs. And my grandma made me breakfast every morning, and I caught the bus there, and I got off the bus there and hung out with her until my parents got off work. And so that is where I grew up. My school was literally like maybe 30 kids in a grade.
No.
Yeah. So had I graduated from there, because we moved later, but had I graduated, I think I would have been, there would have been like 25 kids in my graduating class.
Oh my God. That's like, that's amazing. Like, yeah. I have no idea what that would have been like. I think there was 40,000 billion kids in my graduating class. You couldn't find me in the picture.
Yeah. So we had like, there was two classes per grade growing up. Mm-hmm. So there's like just two teachers. So there would be like 12 to 15 kids in your class.
Yeah.
And then when we got to fifth grade is when we had like half classes with one teacher. You had your homeroom, but they were trying to prepare us for junior high. Can you imagine? They were trying to prepare like 30 kids. Oh God, how big will junior high be?
Yeah.
So funny to me now.
That's hysterical.
It's like in your junior high will still be less than 100 kids for all three grades, but it's overwhelming. So I grew up there until, we moved. My parents got divorced when I was 13.
Okay.
And my mom got remarried, and my stepdad worked for, she was a secretary at a, they sell farm equipment, kind of a business.
Farm equipment.
Uh-huh.
The more words you say, the less you and I are similar in any sort of way.
Yeah, we're getting there.
You're absolutely.
You're definitely more Jasmine. I'm a lot more Aladdin. It's true.
That
you didn't know that, but I'm Aladdin, bitch. So right. Anyway,
you heard it here first, folks.
So then, my stepdad was a salesman who was based out of Indiana, but because he traveled a lot, that's how they like got to know each other.
Yeah,
and so when they got married, he wanted to start his own business of the same thing. And he had so many different states as kind of his territory that I don't remember why it was Ohio is where he decided to base his business. But so we moved to Ohio. My brother had already graduated. He's 5 years older. So he was 18. He was going into the National Guard. Because again, we had no money, so he needed to pay for college.
Right.
And he was going off to boot camp. And I was about to be a junior in high school when we had to move two states away. And my mom is the oldest of six kids, and they all had a lot of kids. So there was like 27 grandkids. And I was super close with my grandma, cut to me getting breakfast with her every morning and hanging out all the time.
Totally.
And that was really hard for me because, you know, I was used to having my grandma and grandpa right there. Not mentioning my grandpa much. Sorry. I love you too, grandpa.
Oh, absolutely.
Both in heaven. But yes, but you know what I mean? Like my grandma and I were buddies, and I had all these cousins and aunts and uncles. Anyway, so we move away from everyone. And right before junior year of high school, it's really hard. So we moved to another small town in Ohio, Northwest Ohio, called Archbold. And that was about 100 kids in a grade, which again, I thought was huge.
Yeah.
Because I went still, from 25
that's not even
to 100.
To normal. I mean, like.
Literally still it's very small. Yeah. But I was like, I was from 25 to 100. Oh my God. How does anyone keep track of this?
Right. Like, this is what crazy. China must be like. Yeah.
I'm ready for a city now. Yeah. No.
What was your New York prep? Wow.
But it was a good prep for like, you know, college wasn't terrifying to me because I already had to leave everybody and everything I knew and start over again and make friends. And I have, I'm kind of like both extrovert and introvert. Like if I know a group of people, I can be super extroverted and like, let's be fun and let's, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But if it's like a group of people that already know each other, it is not the easiest thing for me to immediately be me right. in that space.
Right.
And be like, hey, how's everybody doing? And some people are great at that. That's not my ministry.
Right.
So I can fake it though. And yeah. But it's very hard to like, kind of like, let's go act today. Cause what it
yeah,
felt
you
like.
Really do have to like find new energy to put inside of
yes.
you for that kind of thing. Yeah,
yes.
absolutely. It's stressful.
Yes. So, but I managed to do it. I found some really beautiful, wonderful friends. And anyway, I finished high school there. And then I got
did any of these friends become lifelongers, or are these like people that were like just part of that chapter?
No, I definitely have some lifelongers that like even
it.
Like traveled out to New York to see me in Head Over Heels.
Oh, come on now. We love
yeah,
it. Yeah.
Yeah. So met some really great people. And then Ohio State University offered me lots of money. Again, not in a paper bag, but via scholarship.
Right. Yeah.
And
a paper bag. Like, that wasn't even part of the joke earlier, but I love the idea of just giving you a lunch bag of some cash.
Just so shady, but you're like,
I love
take it.
It.
I need it.
Yes.
I don't know. So I ended up going there kind of begrudgingly, like, I wanted to go out of state. I wanted to go to New York.
But was college always part of the agenda for you? Was that always
yeah.
something that you were
yeah.
told to do or that you wanted to do?
I think both. I think I was a pretty smart kid. Somehow I went into theater.
Yeah.
But
That's right.
I don't know how that happened. Somewhere I lost the brains. I was a straight A student and I was very like obsessed with kind of being that perfect kid and trying to get all the straight A's. And, you know, I wasn't like I didn't like ever drink until college. Like I didn't really curse much. I was very much a good girl. I really
yeah,
was.
Yeah. Wow. What a loser.
Right. No, if you are one of those kids listening, you are beautiful. Don't
you're beautiful.
Listen.
Keep being you. Don't listen to Uncle Drew. He's a horrible example.
Don't turn into an actor. So anyway, I had kind of always like had straight A's and, you know, I graduated. I can't remember the names. There's magna cum laude and summa. Which is higher? Is summa higher?
You are asking. I think there couldn't be a wronger person to ask
Amazing.
That question to. But let's
Amazing.
Go ahead and say, yeah, it's smomo. What did you say?
Smomo.
Mush mush?
Summa.
Yeah. You were mush mush cum clago.
So there's either like the 4.0, everything's A, that's the top. And I was the one below it because.
Oh, so what you're saying is you were, I mean, like really given the thumbs up in college. I mean, like it was your grades and your efforts were acknowledged.
Yeah. Even when I started drinking, I still was able to like.
Weird. I started seeing my grades go up the minute I started drinking. It's crazy.
All the time. Yeah, no. So, I ended up, but I loved Ohio State because, I mean, it is a Big Ten school. So we had the football games, we had everything. And the theater department, they didn't have a musical theater degree, which I'm really glad I didn't end up in because that's where I would have gone had I gone to a conservatory,
right.
which we just like could not afford.
Right. Because they do ask, and I hope they're all listening. I hope all you fucking conservatories are listening right now. Jesus Christ, you're trying to you're create artists in these programs. Why are you asking them for so much money? They can't pay these loans off.
So
you're crooks.
Much money.
You are crooks. Boko,
so
I hope
money.
You're listening.
And even with like all of the scholarships, because again, I was super smart and I applied for like every scholarship ever because again, we did not have money. And I got a lot of them and still it was just like not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something when I remember, you know, kind of learning about it in sociology class in college, but there's just a mindset that people don't take when they want to like judge poor people or judge anybody from a different class. Like, why don't you just try? Why don't you just apply yourself? But you don't understand the mindset that is instilled in you. You don't like believe, oh, anything's possible. Oh, we can. Yeah, we'll find ways to get that money. No, yeah. Because yeah. It's like when your parents have struggled, when your parents have been like, let's just make sure we have food on the tip. You know, my mom made $16,000 a year
when my
parents divorced and she was like a single mom for a little bit with just me. Yeah. And had it not been for our grandparents that owned the trailer we were in, and, you know, as my mom has told me, like how much they helped her financially, that we could have been like, it could have been real, real rough, you know?
Well, let me ask a question here, because this, you bring up something really interesting. You come from really lean times. You come from, yeah. I mean, 16,000, that's a drop in the well compared to what everybody else should be making and what is survivable, what's livable.
Yeah.
But yet you had a passion for something that you would think a family that is in that situation would never even allow that to be a yeah. dream lived, because no, you got to earn a buck and that's a silly way to go. And it's going to take you forever to get there. And, you know, so what was the conversation within your family of like pursuing such a lofty dream? You know, it yeah. seems lofty until you get close and then it's a job like anything else. But like in those times, talk about that a little bit. I'm so curious.
Well, what's also funny is there was so much when I was little and I was like, I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to be a newscaster. Random. My mom recently found something where I said that when I was five. Amazing. I was going to be a newscaster.
5 years old. I love
five.
It.
Five. Newscaster. Also, not like a news person. I was like, yeah, I would like to be a newscaster. What? Okay. Random. And then I wanted to be a vet. I wanted to be a doc, you know, all these different things. And yeah. then it was like, I got the lead in the school play when I was 10 years old for there the Christmas is. Play. Mm-hmm. And again, this was the super small school. So what the fifth graders were the actors, right. and K through four in the school gym, you know, the fifth graders would be on the stage in the gym, and then they would yep. bring out the risers, like where they would usually put, you know, absolutely. I don't know sports terms, the audience for the game.
Yeah, the audience for the ball throwing and whatever happens.
For all of that yeah. jazz. And yeah. K through four would sit in the risers, the, you know, the stand, I don't know uh-huh. the words. And they would put chairs on the court for the audience. Yes. And because you could fit the entire elementary school like that, because there were so few of us. But anyway, the K through four would sing all the songs and the fifth graders were the actors. And that's how yeah. we did the Christmas show every year. So wow. by the time you're the fifth grader, you're like, I get to be on stage.
Yeah, you get a and part. Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's been building up when you've been sitting in them risers, mm-hmm. watching it every year. And it was, I don't remember the name of the show, but it was something about, I want to say it was like the elf who saved Christmas.
Yeah, that old one. Yeah.
And I was the elf who saved Christmas.
Yes, you were, Bonnie. Come on.
Okay. I was Georgianne was her name.
That's a great elf name. Right. Georgianne.
Georgianne. Georgianne. Not Georgia Ann, just Georgianne.
Just Georgianne. Yeah, that's great.
And there was some other elf that was there too. I don't remember that elf's name because who cares?
Who cares? Honestly, everybody was talking about Georgianne after the show anyway.
Thank you. and it was like a light bulb went off and I was like, oh my God, this is it. Yeah. And I got my first B+. This is fifth grade, so it doesn't really matter. Right. In science, because I just didn't, I was just learning my lines. I didn't care. Right. And again, school was always easy for me. So the fact that I really didn't care at all and that somehow was still a B+ was like,
yeah,
should have been amazing. Like, wow, girl. And
the image in my head is you at 10 years old and your teachers are like, Bonnie, you're really behind on your work. And you're like, please call me Georgianne. For like 2 months.
I'm trying to find where she's coming from. Can you just say Georgianne?
Yeah. Method acting, driving the other students crazy. That's just like, I love that idea.
And it was the other teacher. Like I said, we started to change classes. Like, and it was the her name was Miss Wood, and she was amazing. Mm. She was like fresh out of school. And my homeroom teacher, Mr. Deramaya, was very intense, and he liked gifted students. Like, he was very biased. If you were smart, you were his favorite. If you struggled, he didn't really have time for it.
Right.
And he would have us, it was very weird. We were 10 years old, right? Like 10 and 11 is fifth grade. And he would have someone at the back chalkboard write out high honors, honor roll, honorable mention. And he would say the names out loud and they would write it on that chalkboard. So all of us knew where everyone stood.
He created like a sick little hierarchy within the classroom.
And in fifth grade, nobody cares yet. You know what I mean?
That's except what Donald Trump does with his kids, I think. He's like, Don Jr., you're here. Eric, you're here. And then whatever, the one that starts with a T, you're in an honorary mention.
Yeah.
Honorary mention. Tiffany,
she's a master.
Poor Tiff.
I don't even know if she made honorary mentions, because there were people that didn't even get on that list, because those were all like, you know what I mean? Like, if you got a D, like, you weren't up there at all. And I was already very like concerned about getting everything. And I had just gotten a B plus, and it was unheard of. And I was already still, this is around the time I was kind of fighting the teacher's pet stigma, because then he really also took a very strong liking to me in the way of, like, he would give me extra projects, or if people would go to recess, he wanted me to help him decorate his window. And it was like stuff like that. So it was already like, oh, teacher's pet. Oh, straight A, Bonnie. And people didn't even need to know that. But the day that he did not write my name on the list, everybody in the room literally was like, Bonnie? Because he went, high honors, no one. And everybody turned to me. And I went to the next class, and Miss Wood was like, saw that I was so distraught. And she's like, okay, everybody, Bonnie, can I see you real quick? And she took me out in the hall.
Yeah.
And she's like, what's going on? And I had like a full breakdown. And she was like, it's my subject. It's a B plus. It's still good. And I know. And she was so sweet, because she saw me and she was like, I know that you're really worked up about the play right now. And I was like, yeah.
She was like, she understood.
She fully did. And she was like,
she understands Tech Week. She gets it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
And so I was, she kind of had a moment with me, and she was like, if you keep up like this, you're going to have an ulcer by the time you're 15. I remember that clear as day.
Wow.
And so she really encouraged, it's okay to love this thing that you're doing. Like, you need to take the pressure off of yourself a little bit, like with this other. And that's kind of when I don't know why I went into that story, but that's just part of my life. Deep dive.
Well, I was, this was but the going back to way of answering how in the world you got into theater or the arts at all in this kind of environment, in this town.
And also my parents met when my dad was the new lead singer of the Southern gospel group my mom was the pianist for.
Oh, so music is definitely in the family.
Music has always been there. And so my dad was a preacher as well as they would sing. So as soon as I could talk, I was singing in front of the church.
Yes.
So that was always there. The acting part didn't come till I was 10. And I was like, wait. But I was always performing singing wise for people. And my dad, I know he always wanted desperately to be a singer. And my dad was a beautiful singer. But he did not have that support. And because also he didn't grow up like, I don't know. He didn't, it was not a religious house. He became a Christian. I think he was like 17 or 18. He was older. And he, at one point, like, maybe he was older, because he was like kind of rebellious and hitchhiked his way from Michigan to Florida at one point to be a caddy for some golf thing, like this kind of stuff. But he wanted to go to school for music, and he did the Meadow Lane, the Meadowbrook Music Academy somewhere in Michigan. He did that for a little bit, and he really wanted to do that. And then he didn't really have that support, and then he kind of became religious, and then I think he wanted to do Christian music. And that's when he started singing with like quartets and stuff. And it's the Southern gospel, the I don't know, the white gospel.
Yeah, there's still good. There's some toe-tapping good jams up
there. There's some really beautiful harmonies and really, really good singing. And so that's kind of where he started going into that world. Yeah. So I think there was a certain degree of knowing that was in my blood. And my mom, I don't know, she was just kind of like always on board about it. They saw, they knew about the singing in the church and stuff. And I remember being very little and having people come up to me afterwards and be like, "You're anointed." They would say those words with me. And they're like, "You just like crying, like you just kind of changed my life." And I was like five. And you're like, "What?" So there was something special that happened when I sang for people that, well, at least we as a family felt.
Yeah.
My brother, beautiful singer. He doesn't care though. Like he now like sings at his church, but it just was never for him. And it was like, very for me. I remember I was five and I got to sing the verses for one of the songs and my family only did the choruses and I was very jazzed about that.
Yeah.
And my brother was like, "Do I have to sing?" And I was like, "Can I take his verse?"
Wow. Thanks. You belong in the spotlight. You really, really, really do.
Hey, this interruption means we have made it to the very middle of the episode. It's around this time that I like to chime in and remind all of you sexy Nimrods to go support our guests. How can you do that? Well, they'll tell you how. All you got to do is follow them on their social medias. So please check out what they're up to and what they're doing and who they're supporting and who they're performing for and where they're performing, etc., etc., etc. You can find Bonnie Milligan on Twitter at Belting Bonnie or on Instagram at Belting Bonds. I mean, not right now, but right after this podcast.
I look at the impact you've had on your fans through before Head Over Heels. I mean, like, let's even talk before Head Over Heels. The, you know, the little microcosm inside the microcosm of doing these concerts in New York before you do the big Broadway show or just doing that as a byproduct of being an artist in New York. These videos of Bonnie Milligan singing are a lot of them are gigantic for these younger artists who see this presence and this voice, and you just command a room in a way that is, I imagine it was the same feeling when you were five. Does it feel the same to you now, or is it old hat?
It does feel like really special, like every time that it happens. There's also something that, like, you know, right before I do any show, I mean, it got a little different for Head Over Heels because there's a degree of when you do a show 8 times a week, same with when I did Kinky Boots, that you're like, okay, we know how to do this. We don't have to like freak out. But there is a degree of like nerves that happen right before that curtain goes up every time, which I think is important and good. But then once you start, you're like, oh, I'm at home here. And it goes away. And excuse me, burp. That's kind of how I felt. How I felt about performing live right before. So I started doing a lot of the concerts in 2014. And it was just one of those things where I was just saying yes to anybody that would ask. And I did a lot of kind of new composer evenings where there'd be a ton of different composers. What did they used to be called? It was like It Happened in New York or Once Upon a, I don't know. Jen Tepper used to produce a lot of them. You know what I mean? There was like a series.
Now I can't remember it either. It was her guy with three names. I can't remember.
Yeah. So there was like series that would like, and this is another one of the, where it would just, they would pick a theme and have a bunch of writers have a song about it.
Right.
And I started doing those, and which was great because then you meet a bunch of different composers and one night you sing one song and a bunch of people just heard you live and they're like, oh, wait, maybe we should do something or whatever.
Absolutely.
And I was just doing any concert that would have me in for that year. And I was at 54 so much that Dylan Bustamante and Jen Tepper were both like, you need to do your own show. And I was about to leave for Kinky Boots. They asked me, I think around the July 4th weekend, I had just performed at like a Bitching and Belting thing.
Right.
And I was leaving August 20th. And I'm like, I'm about to leave. And they're like, well, can you put a show together? And I said, yep. And I had never, that's that.
The way you just told that was like, oh my God, I'm about to leave, but can you put a show together? Yes, I can. It was like, there was the fear and the anxiety of the short amount of time you had before leaving jumped out the window and you were gung-ho, ready to go.
Deadline's good. No, it was like scary, but I thought, yeah, I could, right? Yeah. And I had worked a lot with David Dabin, doing some off Broadway shows, and I'd met his partner Andy Einhorn, who had seen me in the shows where David had written music and I'd done stuff. And David was like, "I'm going to be out of town, but I think Andy would love to work with you." Andy does like Audra McDonald concerts. I'm like, "I'm sorry, what?" Like, he would want to do like my 54 Below show. And he was like,
hell yeah, he'd want to do your 54 yeah. Below show. I wouldn't be surprised at that at all.
And he was MDing Bullets Over Broadway at the time. Uh-huh. And so I would have all day rehearsal for Kinky Boots. And yeah. I was around the corner because I feel like Bullets was on 44th or something. And I was rehearsing at 42nd. So I would get done with rehearsal and I would jump over there because he would have night shows and I would have day rehearsals and we would kind of do that or weekends. And I went all the way up to his dressing room and we put together a show. And I'm so grateful for him because he's like, you get three numbers. I yes. want you to think about this show of what would a fan of yours expect. And I was like laughing and belting. And he was like, okay, now you get three songs that are just for you. And it doesn't matter if it fits any of those. It doesn't matter if a fan would be like, what the heck is that song? You get three of them that are okay. hands down, whatever you want to do. It doesn't matter. And I was like, okay. And then it was like, it's too much to worry about trying to learn songs right now. What do you know? What can we pull that like feature these things? And it was,
he was your supple awning. He caught you.
Supple awning.
He was your supple yeah. awning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, can I just ask, what were the three songs that you chose that were like a little out of, you know, out of your own pure heart, but may have been a left turn for some of your fans who are going to the show?
So I wanted to do a Doris Day number because okay. I grew up right around, I guess when I was like 12, I remember my mom had talked about loving Doris Day. And so I bought her like a VHS of one of the movies for yes. Mother's Day or something. Yes. And I watched it and loved it. And then I learned about Doris Day, who grew up in Ohio, and she was going to be a dancer. Her story is insane. She was going to be a dancer, like a ballroom dancer. And her and her partner won some competition. They were supposed to go to California and compete. And on the way to the going away party, their car got struck by a train. And
oh my
the
God.
Bones in her legs like shattered. And she was oh. told she wouldn't walk again. And then she was like on bed rest, depressed, because that was her whole life was dancing. Oh. And then was listening to the radio and Les Brown and his big band mm-hmm. and started singing. And then there people were like, wait, you're kind of an amazing singer. And then she like lied about her age and went to audition to be the lead singer of something. She got it. She started touring wow. with Les Brown.
Oh my God.
And they were somewhere. She married her trumpet player. Got like had her baby at like 18, and then he was super abusive. And so yes. she was trying to get out of this abusive relationship and getting divorced. And that was like horrifying in the 40s, you know, yeah. like, oh my God. And she was at a party and somebody was like, she should sing. And they're like, she was so beautiful. They're like, she needs to test for movies because they were all movie musicals.
Yeah.
And she sang at a party and somebody said, let's give her a screen test. And she went and she was such a mess because of her like divorce and everything that yeah. she was a wreck and it didn't go well. She's like, I just need to go back to Ohio. And she did something else. And somebody was like, just have her come in again and do this. She's like, I'm not an actor. And she went in and booked it and literally became one of the top box office draws. It's just someone who's met nothing but adversity.
Yeah.
And like her second husband, they were married for 17 years before he died. And when he died, she found out he had squandered all of their money and oh my she God. Had no money. And he'd signed her up for a television show she didn't want to do, but she was in debt and had to do it. Like crazy stuff.
So something about her story was obviously like, this is the hero everyone should be talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm going to homage this person and sing her yeah. shit tonight.
So I had like listened. I watched, she's 40 movies. I watched them all. I'd watched her TV show, wow. listened to her music nonstop. And she's a big influence. And a lot of people don't. Like they're like, what? You love Doris Day? I'm like, I do.
Yeah.
And so that was that was one of my picks. I even like wrote a paper about her when I was in high school.
This is why I'm had this podcast. This is the kind of shit that I'm like, I never would have guessed that just based on what I feel like you're made to sing all the time. I would never be like, oh yeah, Doris Day is her thing. But this is super interesting. She's like she's one of your muses a little bit.
Yeah, very much.
Wow.
Andy, we matched together two songs. And one of her movies that I love that I really recommend is called Love Me or Leave Me. It's her and James Cagney. And it's all about Ruth Etting, who was a jazz singer back 20s, 30s. And there's just such great music. It's like some of the best music. So we put together You Made Me Love You. And what's the other one? I can't think off the top of my head, but we combined two and he made like a waltz kind of trance. It was just really
love
beautiful.
That.
So we,
I love that.
We did that. And I remember a lot of people like, I did not know, like when you talked about Doris Day, like what? And, so that was like important to me. Another one was actually his partner, David's song. David and Dick Scanlon wrote a song called Wildflowers, which I had done at one of these concerts, which I think might've been my first big concert that kind of started it all for me.
Yeah.
And I have such a passion for working with new musical theater writers and singers. That was another big thing that I had a lot of that music in my show and some Cumin and Diamond and
love those boys.
Yeah. Just like people I've worked with and that I was like, that's important to me to also sing some stuff that isn't, you know, just Whitney Houston, which I also did.
Right. Well, sure. That's the part where you're giving them what they want, right? That's the part where you're giving them the big voice. I mean, Whitney Houston is such a big voice. And I mean, for Christ's sake, your Twitter handle is Belting Bonds or whatever. Belting Bonds.
Yeah, that's Instagram.
So, I mean, like, it's out there. People expect that of you.
Yeah.
I like when you give the treats, though. And, you know, to be honest, that was some of my favorite parts of working with you on the album that we did. We Aren't Kids Anymore. Again, go buy that shit, kids. But it was like a duet, like on and on and on with you and Lily Cooper and stuff like that. Yeah. I don't feel like I get to hear you do stuff like that enough because you're always given the big note, which you excel at in spades, but you have so much more to offer. And I love when people are like surprised, like I had no idea that blah, blah, blah. Why not? You take 5 minutes to talk to Bonnie. I would right away assume, oh, you've got to be the most cultured and versatile performer. One of them, at least out there, you know, just take a look at the stuff that interests you. Not necessarily what people want you to do. I think you are gifted in like every avenue you could possibly go down. I have such a talent crush on you, Bonnie. I really do.
Thanks, but I gotcha.
Well, hey. Look at us. A couple of awnings for each
look
other.
Look at us. Couple awnings.
Do you think that doing this 54 Below show, I mean, we're going to talk about career now because we're kind of there. We're in New York. We're talking about in your 54 Below experience. I mean, we're not physically in New York right now. We're very not there. But just in terms of your story right now, I kind of want to lead up to Head Over Heels, because in my eyes, as an observer of your career, which I was just an observer before we ever got a chance to like hang out and dilly dally and fuck around in a studio or what have you, I was watching you do these new musical theater concerts.
Yeah,
I know that you went on the road with Kinky Boots for a while, but Head Over Heels seemed to be this really big turn for you in your career. It was that your performance in particular was very talked about and very written about. And there was a lot of praise. I didn't see any negative words about Bonnie's performance in that show. I thought you were so spectacular. How did that, did it, first of all, did it change your life? And if so, in what way?
Yeah. I mean, when I went on tour, what was really crazy when it kind of was building up to it, you know, we had stage doors in every city and I hadn't done anything big of note. You know, I'd done off-Broadway and off-Broadway. And I had some of the videos from the other concerts I'd done. And then I had just put out videos from my own concert.
Yeah.
And I would have people at the stage door that had seen my videos.
Yeah.
That would, and also another thing is I was playing Pat, she was the redhead in Kinky Boots, who was kind of the office manager, who looked cute. She did the tango with Lola at the top of Act Two. So mm-hmm. I had lines. I had a little solo bits here and there and like ensemble things. Just a featured ensemble. But because I think of the tango moment that was like a featured dance, I would have women of size wait to tell me what it meant to see a bigger girl on stage in Kinky Boots doing a featured ensemble track, dancing and being beautiful because she was dressed really cute and she had a great wig. God, that was a good wig. And I already was just feeling the stirrings of that when I did Kinky Boots, like going across the country and feeling either what they had identified with watching me on stage dancing. And I made sure to tell the producers and to tell Jerry Mitchell. And I was like, I just need you to know that this is what I'm getting. There was one, I can't remember what city, but one of the reviews brought me up in the review saying that that was another message of the show and that, you know, it was really beautiful to like see that beginning, the churnings of it.
Yes.
Head over heels. I had done the first 29-hour reading of right before I left in 2014. We did it.
So that's when that started for you.
Yeah. And so what I talked about earlier, working with David Dabin, were shows at the Flea Theater off Broadway. Mm-hmm. And there were these epic shows. Like one was a 5.5-hour Greek drama, like all of Sophocles' plays in one evening.
Wow. Wow.
But they added, so starting with Oedipus Rex and ending with Antigone. And
That's a heavy night. That's a real heavy night of theater.
Uh-huh. Sean Graney did the adaptation of this. It was called These Seven Sicknesses.
Yeah.
And so I guess there's seven plays, not five. Good work, Bon. So anyway, the 5.5 hours, seven. That's there. There it is. And it was, you know, down in Tribeca. And it was all about mingling. Like, so if you would come to the theater, I would greet you in costume and say, hey, can I help you find your seat or anything? I'm Bonnie, nice to meet you. Can I get you a drink? And it was that kind of a mingle, so that it was part of the concept of the director Ed Iskandar that if the audience knows you, they root for you a little bit more.
Right.
And it's not, some people do not want to be mingled and you got to read that and walk away. Yep. And some people are into it. But the first intermission, we would serve dinner. And the second intermission, we would give dessert. And then it was a whole thing.
Yeah.
But through that, because of the mingling, you met a lot of people. And somebody's job was to put out an email before with all the industry coming that evening with their headshot and a bio. So you also,
oh my God.
And the director was like, it's everything's about networking. And so it was just a big learning lesson that year that I spent there.
Yeah.
And Jeff Witte was one of the people that came and was friends with Ed. And I found out later he wrote Head Over Heels with me in mind from seeing those two shows I did there.
Come on, Bonnie fucking Milligan. Just come on now. People are writing parts for you. This is legend status. You're there. You're there. That's Lapone.
What's funny is I found, like, still, even when I found out he like wrote this for you, like at one point there was a short list of, I don't remember how I saw it, but it was like just celebrity names to see if they would do it first, like Adele. And so this is like years ago, you know, and I'm like, oh, great. You know, and then any celebrity fat person there was just like on this list. And you're like, great. But we did the 29-hour reading and then I got this tour, and the tour, I wasn't even an Equity member yet. I didn't have an agent. I had no Equity card.
Oh my God. I had no idea about that. That's amazing.
Yeah. I got my Equity card doing Kinky Boots. And so they at first were, the director was like, don't do that tour. And I was like, because it was going to go to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in 2015. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to do a workshop of it in November 1st. And I was like, I'm going to take this tour. And if it's meant for me, you guys can get somebody to do that November week Yeah. Which was just pre-production for OSF, which right. a lot of the time they cast their shows over the summer, and then not everybody is out in Oregon yet, so they usually don't use the cast for the pre-production anyway. It's just
right.
for people out there to be like, oh, we'll use. It's not even, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
A lot of the time they don't use their cast, and they were trying to be like, don't do that, so you can do this. And I was like, you know what? I'm gonna take this big tour.
Yeah,
and get my equity money's card.
Good. Yeah, the equity card's good, and the payday's all right. Hell yes.
And do a first national tour. You know, you're working with Jerry Mitchell and Harvey Weinstein. With not Harvey Weinstein. I'm so sorry, Harvey Firestein. Oh God!
Listen, I made that same exact slip up. I'm just so happy I haven't done it on this podcast.
That's and horrifying.
I'm so happy there was no supple awning for you to catch you there.
That was a trampoline into a ditch where I got a head injury from a rock.
Oh my God, Harvey Firestein! If you ever hear
Harvey
this,
Firestein, don't.
That's not you. Yeah.
Well, I still love you. Please still love me back. Oh, kill me. No, Harvey and Cyndi Lauper. Everybody was there. So, you know, like we were really kind of
creating
what the tour would be. Yeah. So anyway, I did that, and I had to submit an audition tape. And because it was the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, everything's in rep. So I had to do a couple of Shakespearean monologues and do all that, which I had that training from college.
Yeah.
And I got it. So I did the tour for 7 months, and then I left to go do Head Over Heels in Oregon.
And when that transferred to Broadway, because it was pretty short after that, it wasn't a long waiting period, was it? Or am I crazy?
Well, so we were
in Oregon.
You
guys did San Francisco or Berkeley or something after that?
San Francisco, 2018, right. Yeah.
My parents saw that.
They did.
They did. They loved it too. They called me up right away to tell me how much fun it was. They absolutely loved it. My dad was like, I thought I was going to hate it, but it was so fun.
Oh God. I loved being out there in San Francisco. They were such good crowds. Oh, so good.
Perfect for that show.
It's a great city for that show. Yeah. God. So we were at OSF in 15 from, you know, I was out there 6 months. I came back in October of 2015, and then they overhauled it all. Like, I got a call in like February that they were essentially, it was a very strange call, basically restarting with everybody except me. Like,
wow.
The entire cast, the entire creative team, who was left was Jeff Witte and myself.
Wow.
And the Go-Go's, but they hadn't yet been involved. I met 4 out of the 5 Go-Go's came to the Oregon opening. Belinda couldn't make it. She like lives in Bangkok, I think.
Yeah.
So it was a weird call to get because it's a show you care so much about. And my grandmother had died right before I went to Oregon. It was a very hard, hard year. You know, yeah. I was on the road. My grandma died. It was very sudden.
Yeah.
And then I leave the tour a month later of everybody that held me up during that to go to a place where I don't know anyone at a Shakespeare festival, one of the most prestigious ones in the country, which is already super intimidating.
Yeah.
And they have a company. So here and there, they do hold auditions for people. I'm outside of the company. So I'm talked about because I'm the one coming in that now people are talking about, oh, this was written for, oh, she's the lead of the musical. Like, who is this?
Right.
And so you're like, God, I have to live up to these expectations and I have to prove myself. And only a few people made me feel like that, but I did get that.
Yeah, that's still what treatment.
But then those people, it's so funny, became very, very dear friends of mine. But at first they were like, who are you?
Yeah.
But and we joke about it now. And I was like, you were scary.
Yeah.
And it became the most amazing time of these people that were so beautiful who held me up in another way, you know? And so I came back to New York and that was a hard transition for me. And then to hear, oh wait, everybody that really held you up, like they're all gone. And a lot of them who work there, they're like, we know we get replaced a lot.
Yeah.
It's not easy, but we're used to this. And so it was really strange. So Michael Mayer took over and we had a workshop up at Vassar in 2016.
Okay.
Then we did a lab in January of 2017.
Okay.
Then 2018 is when we went to San Francisco and then Broadway.
And then Broadway in that fall, right? Is that what it was? Yeah.
Summer.
And that production on Broadway was all too short-lived. That's my personal thought on the whole thing. I thought it was so fun and great and beautiful once you really got the juice of what the show's about and the importance of the storytelling and the casting. I thought was so magnificent.
The best cast, yeah.
And when that came to an end, real quick, I just want to know, like, what did you feel your future was going to be after that? Because you'd made such an impact in that short amount of time just with your performance and the buzz leading up to the Broadway opening. When it didn't get the length of the run you would have hoped for, perhaps, did you feel like, but I'll be okay because of this? Or did you feel like, okay, it's back to the hustle, which is certainly part of the gig of being an actor? What was, like, what were the fears and what were the securities you felt?
There's definitely like a bit of both of that. Like it was so heartbreaking. You know, it was coming because the houses just weren't full. And we had a producer from Oregon, who Louise Gund, who believed so much in us in the show that she just kept us open. And you know, we could have closed. People are like, you're going to close in August. And you're like, huh? But we stayed open through January. You know, we had a 6.5 month run, which is nothing to balk at.
No, not at all. You're right.
But it's way too short for the show. Some people are like, had it happened this season, it would have been embraced. And you're like, it's frustrating when people say you were just a little ahead of your time, which is annoying because you're like, but
especially
doesn't
when
that
it's
mean...
like years, like just tiny amounts of years.
You're like,
you know,
but doesn't that mean we were needed when? And I know that we were, like, our audiences that we found were really beautiful, and it was special to know what we were doing. What was amazing about the cast? Just 23 of the most beautiful people ever. And we believed so deeply in what we were doing. We had meetings with producers, you know, like, what can we do? How can we turn this around? You know, let's brainstorm. Like, we were too desperately trying to fix it. And that's hard when you come out and the curtain rises and you see the group of people. And we were all in a pose behind a table, save for Peppermint. But 15 of us were standing there when the curtain would rise up. And sometimes you would just go, okay. And you could do that with each other. You could feel it. Like, we're going to do this show, because something about that cast is we gave it every show, because even a small house, they were so with us that, like, it was real. Even the quiet ones, you could feel them still, because not everybody's loud laughers, but it had been such a road of feeling like you're just shouting into the wind. So that when we got our closing notice, you know, I cried and cried, of course. But you felt it coming. You had to feel proud of where you were. And frankly, like, to be very honest, I felt a lot of dreams crushed. I had so hoped that this would be such a breakthrough for me, and selfishly and in a lot of ways. Like,
well, you just clocked the years you put into this. This is not like it opened and you had 6 months. This is 2014 all the way to early 19.
Early 19 is when we closed.
So I mean, we're talking like 5.5 years here. This is a lot of time to be put into something. So of course your dreams felt that way, and who can blame you?
And I'm not somebody that easily gets cast in these types of roles. You know, I was standing center stage by myself, belting out a song about how beautiful I am. And getting to be a romantic lead and getting to have a full character arc and doing things that usually you're relegated off to the side and you might make a quick joke. And it was like, I feel like we're changing things that need to be changed. Like when I was on the road and someone was changed by me doing a dance solo.
Right.
A duet, I mean. But like, things that you're like, people are hungry for this and hungry for this representation and hungry for something that, like, I don't know why it's so taboo to, like, cast a big girl in this way. Like, you don't have to explain why she's there. I was never explained why I'm in this role ever.
Right, right.
And so, and it was intentionally written like that, but it was never spoken of in the show.
Right.
And so it's like you feel this wave of like it's needed, but also the pullback of it. So it's super frustrating. And you hope for running through things. And I you know, again, you selfishly feel, it sounds dumb, but like award season's maybe not going your way now.
Right.
And which are is like a career thing because people get things and then their career sails. You're going to get a TV appointment if you have this award or this nomination. And so it becomes a business thing as well as a dream that you've had since a kid tuning into the Tonys every year.
It's like the permission. I always say you like what each step you take in your career gives you permission to the thing you really want to do down the line, like whether it's TV or movies, you have to get some other accolades so that the rest of the industry gives you permission to kind of keep going. That's what it feels like, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it became the sadness of the show closing, the sadness of this dream of this specific show and knowing what this show said and meant to so many people across all gender identities and sexual orientations and sizes and everything, that how much it meant to such a widespread amount of people.
Yeah.
That disappointment, the disappointment in just, again, my own career of what it could have meant had it been a smash hit, which I felt like it should have been and could have been. Yeah. And then you're like, am I going to be forgotten all over again? Because it took a really long time to get me here. And what does this mean? And on top of just being sad about the show itself and what it would mean to the fans.
Right.
So it was rolled up into all of that and the fear of you're not, no one's going to like care anymore because it was hard enough to get them to tune in to anything you were doing before.
Right. It's like you said, it's like you're shouting into the void at times and you don't, I mean, like, I know we keep going back to this joke, but like, it's kind of been used as this metaphor now. You don't have the awning beneath you to catch you.
Yeah.
You really don't. And that is a scary circumstance to be in.
Yeah.
Bonnie, we're about to hit an hour here. So I want to just wrap this up with one big final thing here. And first I'll say that good Lord, as a creative and a writer in this industry, I can tell you from every conversation I've ever had, you are so far from forgotten after that role. You are so, so talked about. You always got a place in anything I write. And I hope you know that because I'm bewildered by your talent.
Yeah.
But I want to end by saying this. 2020 has been a diarrhea volcano in a lot of ways. And I mean, for, you know, nationwide, worldwide, of course, but and we do not have to discuss this at all, but I just want to say that I know that, we talked about your dad and, he was a pastor. He was a musician. The man lives on in you in every respect, I'm sure, but we lost him this year. And I'm going to say, first of all, I'm so sorry that had to happen on top of every other shitty thing that had to happen in 2020.
Yeah.
But going forward and hopping into this new year, let's pretend we got the Etch-a-Sketch in front of us and we get to shake it. Okay.
Yeah.
What is it that you draw for yourself in 2020? What do you want to see yourself doing more of? How are you going to continue maintaining the output that you've made it so clear? It's not just for you and your greedy artistic soul. It is for others. You see the impact you have on others. And that's such an important thing. The impact your family had on you. How are you going to carry all of that into 2021? Is it more Broadway? Is it more theater? Is there other avenues you want to start going down if you had all the resources to do so? What would you be doing in 2021?
I mean, if I had all the resources and all the people on my side, I would love to I would love to be a little bit more creating myself. And it's something I used to call myself a writer, and I haven't written in a long time. And then that like weird voice comes in your head that's like, that's not good enough, or you can't do that. And I joined Cameo and I started writing little parodies for people to sing their name and to sing their message. And that all of a sudden I was like, hold on. And it was like my own way of just, I wanted to make them special messages. So I just started writing those. And I was like, I need to do more creating, and there's so much that has happened, God, in this last year especially, but the last few years, that I'm like, I need to put that out into the world somehow, and I would love to do an album. I would love to also write a show that I get to be in, like, or be in the room about, like, yes. that would be like the most ideal ever. And I need to like learn a lot. But if you're asking like fanciful, the best thing ever, I would love to like be on a TV show and me be there and me have a voice in a room about the writing of it.
Yep.
And to be like, this is, let's represent some things.
I don't think that's too fanciful. I think that, you know, and God willing, we didn't lose somebody with the Aladdin conversation at the beginning of this. Hopefully people are still listening at this point. But if there's someone listening, let it be heard here. Bonnie Milligan deserves the world and more. And it's not just because you're so talented. It's because of you just painted such a good picture of yourself. You are generous to a fault. You give, you create, and you perform for the sake of others and making sure that your voice is other people's voice. And I will always respect that of you. Bonnie, I love you so much. I can't thank you enough for doing this podcast with me.
Yes. Thanks for having me.
You are tremendous. And I hope we get to work together again soon when we're both not living in our parents' house.
Oh my God. 2020, what have you done to us? We're in our 30s.
We're in our 30s. We deserve better than this. God damn it.
Oh, God.
All right. Bonnie Milligan, I love you. Thank you so much.
I love recording these outros. Hi, it's me, Drew Gasparini, and I just want to let you know that Now We're Talking is a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Go to bpn.fm/nowwe'retalking if you want to find out more about that. You can follow me on all my socials at Drew Gasparini or on TikTok at The Drew Gasparini. A special thanks to Bonnie Milligan and all you listeners. Please rate and subscribe and come back for more. Guys, fuck, marry, kill Waluigi, Wario, or Toad. I think I'd fuck Wario.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.